The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for hanging in there and coming to this talk at the end of the day. As I was saying to Mr. Janikowski, I'll help you with your sleepiness by playing some slow classical music. So it's a pleasure to be with you. I thank God for the opportunity and the ACCS for inviting me. I think I'm going to avoid the podium, not because I'm a modern hip music guy or something like that, and I think it's not good to have a podium, but I'm going to be interacting with the piano at some point, and so I'll just be here. So I was asked to speak about rhetoric and music, and so I will, but before we dig in, I'm going to play for you a recording. It's an excerpt from one of the greatest works in the history of Western art music by perhaps the most famous Christian composer known. Any guesses? Bach? The work, maybe? B minor Mass. I guess you might be able to guess if you know that. So this is from the B minor Mass. Let me play for you one of the central movements, the Cruci Fixus. I'm going to leave this up, otherwise you're going to have to look at me in Patrick garb the whole time because it's my screensaver. So later on I'm going to look at this in more detail. But to start, take in the Cruci Fixus from the B minor Mass. If I were to ask you to comment on what you just heard, it would show that you heard the music, processed it, and understood, perhaps rightly, perhaps wrongly, some of or the entirety of the message that was being communicated. A musical, rhetorical event. Rhetoric, as you all know, is usually described as the art of public persuasive speaking. Good and true rhetoric is only possible following a firm foundation built upon the study and mastery of grammar and dialectic. A rhetorician is trained in the five canons of rhetoric, inventio, dispositio, elocutio, memoria, and actio. He makes use of ethos, pathos, and logos to make his case, drawing on various rhetorical figures to communicate clearly. Music can be described as a combination of five elements. Melody, the arrangements of pitches in succession. Harmony, two or more pitches sounding simultaneously. Rhythm, the arrangement of sounds into various durations. Form, the overall design or pattern of the musical material. And expression, elements used to interpret or give expression to the music. Now, as we consider how to skillfully create and perform music in a mature rhetorical manner, we must, of course, not forget to consider our guide for all things, God's Word. We should strive for truth, goodness, and beauty in our creations. The music should be written to glorify God and edify the hearer. And it should help to illuminate the text so that the hearer might understand it more deeply. Integrity, sacrifice, discipline, joy, and creativity should be evident in the composition. In short, we must take dominion of sound and time and turn them into music in accordance with God's Word, with skill and beauty, by grace, through faith, in humility of heart. So what is meant by musical rhetoric? Christian musical rhetoric. And how do we get there? Of course, we must start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. When you read, you begin with. When you sing, you begin with. Thank you, very good. I'm encouraged. At least I know there are some musicians in the room. Anyway, you just saw the sound of music. Okay, well, musical rhetoric in training. The purpose of learning a language is to achieve full literacy, the ability to read, write, speak, and comprehend with skill and understanding. This is no different in English, Latin, or music. As a language, the teaching and learning of music is well suited to the structure of a trivium, grammar, learning the basic structural elements of music, rhythm, melody, harmony, etc. Dialectic, learning how the elements are used to create music, i.e. music theory. And rhetoric, thirdly, learning how to create, perform, assess music skillfully with understanding. In over 30 years of teaching music and studying it, I've seen no greater means of teaching music literacy than the Kodály method, based on the teachings of Zoltán Kodály, Hungarian composer, ethnomusicologist, and music educator. His approach to music education is magnificently well suited to the classical model of education. It lines up well with Milton Gregory's seven laws of teaching, and it shares many themes and ideas with the enculturation paradigm of Paideia. Kodály's philosophy and efforts in the realm of music education drastically transformed the musical culture of Hungary and subsequently many other places throughout the world with his methodology. In the span of one lifetime, the entire nation of Hungary matured from musical illiteracy to music literacy. So how did he achieve such a transformation? Now, without going into all the history, I would summarize by stating that Kodály had a clear vision, coupled with the requisite skills with which to implement his ideas, and the support of school leaders to put the plan into motion. Not only was he a visionary, he was an active educator. He was David and Chananiah rolled into one. Kodály understood, like many others throughout the ages, that to effect such a change, one must begin with children. The wise builder starts with the foundation and builds upon it. The Kodály method is not simply for musical grammar, as is often left at, being sound to symbol. Children learn to sing, and they eventually start to learn some symbols. It's a comprehensive vision, including dialectic, symbol to sound, and rhetoric, writing music and making music. While there are many resources in the Kadai methodology, it's not a paint-by-numbers curriculum. I would love to discuss the method in more detail with you, but that's not on tap for today. It's not what I was asked to talk about. So you can catch me another time if you're interested or like to know more, for those of you who don't. For now, I will simply recommend the method to you. If you haven't already done so, study it, read up on it, adopt the methodology, and then seek to hire music teachers trained in it or send existing teachers to Kadai certification programs which exist throughout the country. You can get certified in 3 summers, 2 weeks each. Anyway, that's my plug for the Kadai model. Well, it goes without saying that you can't divorce the learning of music, the method, from actual music itself, the material. So one must make choices as to which music to sing and which music to study. In English and Latin, we rely on the classics of Western civilization in the main. In music, this is sadly not the case in many places. In Christian and classical schools, there's really no excuse for eschewing the rich, plenteous, and varied wealth of music in our cultural storehouse. We must teach our children not only to know or appreciate good music, but to love it, sing it, play it to the glory of God. Given the state of American musical culture, we must be very thoughtful and proactive if we wish to recover our musical heritage and change the state of musical culture in America. This must begin with the church. And as faithful servants of the church, ACCS schools are well suited to lead this charge, this change, in the next generation and on as long as God would prosper her work. I'm not going to go into the particulars right now as to what we should sing from our Christian and Western heritage, because this is known and taught at every Christian or secular university, the study of Western music history. We, of course, must exercise wisdom and knowledge as to what is appropriate when, but the information is readily at our fingertips if we would study it. And, of course, this is not a problem if we follow Gregory's first law, that a teacher know his subject. A few quotes to that end. Chedoniah, leader of the Levites, was instructor in charge of the music because he was skillful. That's 1 Chronicles. Necessity demands that music be kept in the schools. A schoolmaster must know how to sing, otherwise I do not look at him. And before a youth is ordained into the ministry, he should practice music in school. Martin Luther. It is more important who the singing master at Piers Varley is than who the director of the opera house is. Because a poor director will fail, often even a good one. But a bad teacher may kill the love of music for 30 years in 30 classes of pupils. Zoltán Kodály. So assuming a skillful music teacher, we must not only deal with questions, what shall we teach and how shall we teach it, we must be able to answer the question, why do we teach that which we teach and to what end? In the Apostle Paul's letter to the Ephesians, he instructs fathers to bring up their children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And Paul is referring to the ancient Greek as well as Judeo-Christian approach to education known as paideia. Douglas Wilson writes, in the ancient world, the paideia was all-encompassing and involved nothing less than the enculturation of the future citizen. Within paideia, music was not simply a subject to be studied or a cultural accoutrement. It was central to determining what an individual, and by extension an entire culture, would be like. The Greeks, patristics, and reformers all spoke of the great power or ethos music has in shaping the morals of man. Consequently, music education was most necessary for the good of the man and the good of society. Plato wrote in his Republic, "For the modes of music are never disturbed without unsettling of the most fundamental political and social conventions." If music does have the power to influence us and shape the culture of a society, we should certainly desire to understand it well and wield it skillfully. Music education, provided within a biblical paideia model, must then be seen as a necessary component of the education of all Christians. Now, as we consider what a music program should look like, I would encourage you to consider 3 models in addition to the Kadai method. I'm not going to go into detail with any of them. I just wish to set them before you to consider today. These examples all emanate from God's people as they sought to obey His Word, which tells us that all men are created in the image of a singing God, Zephaniah 3:14-17, and that all people are commanded to render musical praise to their Creator, as seen in the Psalms and the Prophets. Consider, sing praises to God, sing praises to our King, sing praises, for God is the King of all the earth, sing praises with understanding, from Psalm 47. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, sing to the Lord all the earth, Psalm 96. Sing to Him a new song, play skillfully with a shout of joy, from Psalm 33. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. Colossians 3:16-17. So when King David established the tabernacle worship in Israel, one of the primary elements was the appointing of those who would lead and perform the music, the musical Levites, the first biblical model I'd like to call your attention to. Haman, Asaph, and Ethan were the chief musicians, leading their brethren in singing, quote, accompanied by instruments of music, string instruments, harps, and cymbals, by raising the voice with resounding joy, as we read in 1 Chronicles. And then later, Shenaniah, leader of the Levites, was instructed in charge of the music because he was skillful, not because he just happened to be the first guy David looked at or he had some free time on his hands, but he was skillful. Then later in Israel's history, when Nehemiah dedicates the wall of Jerusalem, we read, now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and singing, with cymbals and stringed instruments and harps. And the sons of the singers gathered together from the countryside around Jerusalem, from the villages of the Netophathites, from the house of Gilgal, and from the fields of Geba and Azmaveth. For the singers had built themselves villages all around Jerusalem. Have you read that before? The singers had built themselves villages all around Jerusalem. We don't love to sing it. Singing villages. Okay, well, at any rate, the two Thanksgiving choirs of Mass, and they stood in the house of God. The singers sang loudly with Jezrahiah, the director. Also that day, they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off, without any microphones. Isn't that nice? So the musical Levites were appointed, trained, and equipped to lead in the worship of God. Additionally, they trained up the next generation in the ways of the Lord and in the way they should go. The Roman Schola Cantorum, established during the early medieval period, was akin to the musical Levites in that it also provided the music, it provided the musical leadership, and the musical training for the worship of God. This model eventually spread throughout Europe and all the way to America. Also in America, a very different type of singing school sprang up in the 18th century. While one component of these singing schools was to train up leaders, they're more known for teaching the rudiments of music and a song repertoire to the average congregant. These schools were taught by itinerant music masters in classes that met just for a few weeks. Unlike hymnals of today, each new hymnal contained in the front a complete music theory textbook. So the general Joes and James would get together and they'd learn the rudiments of music before they would start to learn the songs. And then the practice, of course, I'm sure you're all familiar with it, the solfa practice, which had a little different bent with the shape notes, particularly in the South, where it lasted longest and is still in existence. But the practice continued that before they sang any song, when they gathered together, they sing it first in four parts, no piano, on solfa. I'll use a different version than the fossil law that they would use, but before they sing Amazing Grace, stay sane, maybe with a sound kind of like this. So, do, mi, do, mi, re, do, la, so. So, do, mi, do, mi, re, so. That quality. If you ever listen to it, you know. No. So, I'm not necessarily saying we should continue that sound. However, they all learned to read music. But over against these three examples of God's people endeavoring to play and sing skillfully with understanding the Word of God is the American public school paradigm. Of course, not all schools are the same, and some are quite advanced in their music programs, to be sure. I know some firsthand that are wonderful examples. However, they are not seeking to understand and employ music as a gift of God to the glory of God and the edification of His people. As many of us grew up in such systems, we often fall back upon those models as our only point of reference. So let me briefly address four characteristics found in public schools, as well as many Christian schools. First would be the entertainment or concert-driven paradigm. Schools that do not exist in connection with the church are cut off from the natural and historic performance context of the majority of sacred music. While there's nothing wrong with concerts and presenting them, I do it all the time, it often becomes the tail which wags the musical dog in many school programs. Concerts which seek to entertain. Such a paradigm without fully literate musicians tends to have little to no time to teach anything but the songs. Sadly, this paradigm reaches all the way down to the youngest grades, in which concerts are little more than a time to trot up the kids so that the parents and grandparents can take their pictures. But I digress. If concerts do contain a high level of sacred music, we end up asking the music to do something that it was not meant to do, i.e., entertain us. Sacred music was written for us to entertain it, as it carried the Word of God in the worship of God. We've taken the fish out of the water and expect it to do something for us, and it's not going to do anything but die. So no wonder many people don't enjoy classical music concerts. How would sermons of the Reformers be received if they were offered up during a talent show? Second, vocal-instrumental division paradigm. This is another unfortunate characteristic, that of a competing vocal-instrumental program in which students are usually forced to choose between the two. In most cases, schools end up with one strong program and one weak program because you're forcing the students to choose, and they usually choose one or the other because it gets established. A wedded program would be ideal, in which the vocal and instrumental training strengthen one another, aiming to equip well-rounded musicians. Third, the music appreciation paradigm. The appreciation model is one in which students who do not want to put in the time and effort to actually make music, or have been told that they're really bad at it, learn that Bach had 20 children, many of whom died young, that Beethoven was a musical revolutionary, and that in the 20th century anything goes. Usually nobody learns much or appreciates much. Students' doodling skills do improve, however. And fourth, music as an elective. This last category often exists in tandem with the other three. Music is thrown in the potpourri bag, which contains at least music, art, and drama. Reading an extended list of choices available at many public schools would make us cry or weep, so I will refrain from reading the list of electives. At any rate, music in this model is certainly not a core subject. If only they read their Bible. If only they read the Greeks and the Romans. Surely then they would have vibrant music programs. Okay, let me leave this cursory tour. Perhaps we'll stimulate some discussion in tomorrow's roundtable or elsewhere. I'd like us to consider now musical rhetoric in history and in action. The term music, of course, has origin in the Greek word, the Muses, the nine daughters of Zeus and, I can never say it, Mnemosyne. To muse, as we would say, means to thoughtfully consider or reflect upon. This is a far cry from the associations we have with music today, in which we aim to amuse. The ancients and the medievals also thought of music in three different categories. The music of the spheres, musica mundana, musica humana, musica instrumentalis. Musica prativa, the performance of music, occurred during the Trivium years, while musica speculativa, the natural and theoretical study, the study of mathematical proportions of sound and time, occurred during the Quadrivium. All who studied music would have been trained to write music, eventually using the species counterpoint exercises, which are somewhat akin to the progymnosmata exercises that many use in language. But during the cultural revival of the Renaissance, musical study begins to shift from the mathematical and cosmological aspects of to rhetorical aspects. Musicians wrote treatises upon and made use of literary and rhetorical concepts in music. Pedagogy in music was based on preceptum, exemplum, imitatio. Composition was based on the five rhetorical canons of inventio, dispositio, elocutio, memoria, and pronunciatio, and employed rhetorical figures such as mimesis or dubitatio. Huge treatises. This is the way composers thought. They thought rhetorically. They were trained in Latin school. They applied it to their musical composition. In the Baroque era, we see this growing to two similar, albeit different, directions. In Italy, music was viewed more in line with the art of oratory, or that of aesthetics and affect, emphasizing memoria and actio. In Germany, music was viewed more in line with the art of rhetoric, the exegetical or theological components of music, emphasizing inventio, dispositio, and elocutio. It is this German strand that I would like to consider in some detail. The German musica poetica, the poetic music, as they called it, grew out of the fertile soil of the teachings of Martin Luther. Luther taught that music was second only to the Word of God. There was an idea of the sermon in song with the worship service on Sunday morning, or music as the living voice of the gospel. This is how Lutheran musicians thought of music. Remember the Corinthians, the Colossians passage. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another, not just in sermons, not in small group studies, not in Bible studies, not just in your private time, but in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. I often ask my students, have you ever thought of yourself as actually teaching somebody in a psalm or admonishing somebody with a song? Usually I get a lot of blank stares. Well, no, that's just what we do to kind of wake ourselves up in the middle of service. And we stand, we sing a song, and then we go back to the important stuff, where we listen to non-sung words. There was a synthesis with the German musica poetica in which they put together the speculative and the practical elements of music, and they added a good dose of the poetic, or the persuasive elements. German composers interacted with music in terms of the dominion mandate, in light of the divine order. This way of thinking was imparted through the teaching of the cantor at the Lutheran Lateinschule, the Lutheran version of the Latin schools. It was the cantor who usually taught them Latin as well as music. They were combined. This is not, they didn't study them at the same time, but they were combined in the same teacher. This is another model worthy of our consideration, perhaps the model closest to the prevalent structure of the ACCS schools. Well, as the archetypical musicus poeticus was none other than Johann Sebastian Bach, I'd like us to return to his Crucifixus from the B minor Mass that we listened to at the beginning. Beyond performing it, the memoria and the actio, how can we interact with it on a rhetorical level? Well, let's focus on the first three of the five canons of rhetoric. The inventio, the dispositio, and the elocutio. This is what Bach would have done as he set out to compose a piece like the Crucifixus. I need to, like Pastor Wilson earlier, give a word of warning for those without advanced musical training. I'm going to employ musical terminology, both old and new, as I delve into a musical analysis of Bach's composition. I realize I risk losing some of you by doing this, but I want to provide for you an example of the manner in which our secondary students should be taught to analyze, speak about, and actually compose music. As Padahi might say, this is not a quote of his, but I've read enough that he might say, if he were still alive, which he's not, if you do not get this, or see this, the telos, then your grammar and dialectic teaching will never get you there. So, here we go. A break from the lecture, and on to musical dissection, musical analysis, musical archaeology. Bach's topic, his Inventio, is the text, Crucifixus etiam pronobis supostio Pilato, patus et sepultus est. He was crucified also for us under Pontius Pilate, suffered, and was buried. So what did Bach do next? Just wait until the muses inspire? Well, no. It was time to enter into the dispositio of the composition, the structuring of the composition. The text that he was setting is the awful crux of redemptive history, as we know. The greatest lament ever. The choice of musical forms was clear to Bach. The musical lament, which was a form, was the obvious choice. The lament employs the genre of a passacaglia, or a chaconne, a type of dance. I'm not going to debate which it really is. There's lots of debate on it. I don't want to go into it now. But the chaconne and the passacaglia are slow dances in triple meter. This type of dance... A good friend of mine refers to me as his link to the past. If only he could see me now. I'll have to call him. All right. Well, this type of dance, the passacaglia, uses a recurring bass line, or what's called a ground bass. You see here. And then it repeats itself. And in greatest simplicity, that's all the bass does for the entire composition. Four measures and over again. Simplicity isn't a bad thing. The worship wars, it's always, well, is it good because it's complex? Is the simplicity of pop music a problem? Well, no, there's lots of simplicity. Here's simple. Four measures and that's all you got. Alright? Well, over this, there are a series of variations that Bach employs as he goes throughout the piece. We'll look at them in a little bit. In this instance, in the Crucifixus, Bach uses 13 variations. Numerology is very important to medieval and Renaissance and Baroque composers. It's very likely that Bach had in mind the sense of betrayal or death and mourning with the number 13. In addition to the basic string ensemble, which Bach would have used in scoring most all of his music, he has two flutes. And flutes are used in various ways throughout scripture and throughout history, but one of them was to convey a sense of mourning. And so Bach enhances the scoring, the oral sound of the music, by employing the two flutes. So, and then given the low key topic key, the idea that he's trying to convey, he would pick a key, a place to write it. He chooses a minor key, the key of E minor. But Bach didn't just come up with this all on his own out of the air. He's working within a form that was common to his day. Listen to another famous lament, just the beginning of it, which was written by Henry Purcell at the conclusion of his opera Dido and Aeneas. It's most likely that Bach had never heard this, but it's roughly about the same time, a little earlier than Bach would have written it. Oh, hold on. I have to pull it ahead for about 50 seconds. There was our ground bass, it's descending. Over the aria, the strings and the voice, and the bass repeats itself again.
Thank you.
song is about death, when I lake in earth. And one of the things we see with that ground bass is first that it's descending. And it's descending not just in the scale of the key, but with all these chromatics, all these pitches that aren't in the key. It's very tense. And also, this ground, the whole idea of a ground bass was associated with earth, crucifixion, death, burial. So, this is another version. How about this one? Oh, I got to change. Sorry. I've never done this before in my life. Really, I've never done it. I'm out of my element here. Okay, that comes up. And I'm going to do the, oh, there's no music for this, sir. There's music, but I have to sing it for you. This is from a Vivaldi work. Piango, cemo, sospiro e peno. You again see the form. The bass line is broken up, but it's still G, Fi, F. E, S, D. It's the exact same line. It's actually been suggested that this very work was the work that Bach used to write one of his cantata movements, Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Sagen, weeping, lamenting, grieving, trembling, that he uses as a model. We know for a fact that Bach copied the master Vivaldi, wrote out his works by hand, didn't get to use the copy machine, which would have made him a much lesser composer, to be sure. He copied them out by hand, and then he reworked them, he used the material. Well, Bach later took this music from Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Sagen, and then transformed it into the Crucifixus, which we listened to. I'm not going to play the cantata movement, but if you listen to it, it's in essence the exact same music, at least at the beginning, that you hear in the Crucifixus. This kind of parody was a very common technique in the day. So let me pull back up the Crucifixus score for you. Which means I'm going to close this. I hope this works. And close that. Okay, here we go. All right. So as we look at the score together, I'm going to break it up according to the fivefold division of the dispositio. Again, the exordium, narratio, divisio, confirmatio, and peroratio. Within each section, we're going to take note of some of the most notable musical rhetorical figures, or they would call them the figurandera, which in rhetoric would be the elocutio. In so doing, we're going to see how Bach rhetorically communicates the essence of the message in the music itself. He's not trying to just simply picture the music. Like if he were to say going down, he would go down. Or if he said running up, the notes would run up. That would be something that would be used with only one type of rhetorical means of conveying it. More importantly, they wanted to convey the entire essence of the text in the music itself, not just in this kind of a copycat format. So, the composition begins with an exordium, the start of the piece. And the exordium in this piece, I would suggest, is just these first four measures. We get the presentation of our idea, and that is the lament. Within, you know, I can name that tune in five notes. I can name it. Within probably two notes, anybody in Bach's day could have told you, this is about death. This is a lament. This is a passacaglia. They could have told you many things about it because it's music that was common to the day that Bach appropriated. He wasn't trying to write art music that would confuse everybody, that was out of everybody's league. The dance forms he wrote were dance forms that people danced to. Now, he does something with them that's more elevated than the common dance itself, but everybody would have known what it was. So we have the presentation here of the ground bass. Then we get our strings, and the strings also, talk about simplicity, the entire composition, all they do is 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1. That's all they play rhythmically for the entire composition, and they move almost exclusively by step, hardly a skip in their entire work. This can be played by the second year string players. Maybe not as beautifully, but they could play it. It's simple. I think perhaps Bach's trying to communicate this, just a sense of sorrow as he does this. Now, in this, kind of, or against this rather, the flutes also have their own rhythmic ostinato, and they never change the entire piece. They have rest. Two, three, two, three, two, three, two, three, one, two, three, and they go on and on. With this, there's an emphasis in this dance on the second beat of one, two, one, two, three, kind of like a dragging. It's lamenting. It's heavy. This is what Bach's trying to communicate by picking this form. One of the other things we notice in the exordium is the absence of the choir. They're not there yet. We're going to see, we'll come back to that idea later on. The other thing I'd like to just point out in the bass is Bach uses a very simple rhetorical device. He's just repeating the note. Bom, 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 without ceasing. The entire piece, there's no rhythmic variation for the basses. That's all they do. Trying to create a sense of sobbing. So, that's our opening, the exordium. Our idea has been presented. It's causing you to focus your attention and establish the credibility that this is really about this. If we have time at the very end, I'll play something for you that I think doesn't establish credibility, but I doubt we'll get to do it. But you can hope that we do. You'll be glad. Alright, so we go from the exordium, then we go into the narratio, which is the main idea or the background to the story. But what's the background to this? Simply crucifixus. The crucifixion is the whole deal. And so Bach takes the next two variations 2 and 3, as the choir enters, and he only presents the word crucifixus. He doesn't go into the text all the way yet. What we'll notice here is the first entrance, the sopranos enter, and then the altos, the tenors, and now hopefully the basses come in next. Bach is over and over again going to present the idea of descent, as this ends with the burial of Christ. Another element that we're going to see come back is just a simple idea. Here's our main notes in our song. And the soprano has a dissonance that lasts a long time and then releases. And then the altos come in. And they have a dissonance that needs to be resolved. And the dissonance lasts longer than the consonants. They would have called this extensio, the extension of the dissonance, to create the effect of anguish, of sorrow, right? It's very simple. The two-note figure by itself also would have communicated, yadabong, yadabong, a weeping idea as well. Again, the hearers would have known this as they listened. I think we will go on. Let's see, I have to do this. Pardon me. Supposed to do this. There we are. All right. So, the conclusion of the second variation. Oh, oops. There we go. I was beating myself. Ends here. And then what happens is Bach repeats himself. He wants to make sure you get the point. And he does the same music, but now instead of the sopranos first, it's tenor, singing what the sopranos did, and then the sopranos, and then the basses, and then the altos. What would happen if I drew a line here and drew a line here? Across. You think, oh, you're just making this up, Bert. Come on. No, this is the way these guys thought. Now, you're not going to hear that when you listen to the piece of music, but composers put in the music crosses in the music, the notes themselves. They would draw shapes with the music that pictured a cross. They would have entrances pictured crosses. They would structure music in ways or bigger pieces of work that were chiastic in their structure. It was all over. So Bach has repetition and enters this idea of the cross here, using the same extensio and this weeping motive. So that's our narratio. Then we get into the beats, the divisio, the main points. And here Bach is going to go on with the rest of the text. Crucifixus etiam pro nobis. He's going to do it unfolding the text slowly, two repetitions at a time. So we're going to go a little further in the text. There'll be some repetition of those words. And then we're going to go a little further in the text on the next two variations as he tries to communicate the ideas. So variation 4 which starts right here. We're going to see a new idea. Sopranos lead again. Then the alto and the bass, down here of course. And the tenor is going to come in again. We're seeing this layer upon layer with each entrance again, from generally high to low, but a new idea is appearing. And this, you see, this introduction of more of a chromaticism. Again, trying to convey the idea that the music is tense. There's tension involved in what he's trying to communicate, this idea of crucifixus. And then to balance this, this motive goes up three notes. Page down. Oh, I've got to go page over, sorry. No, I've got to go page down. Ah, I know my problem. I told you I never did this before. There we are. So that was a rising figure. And then our next variation, again, you can always find it by the next repetition of the bass if you're not music readers. Always just look for this, and that'll restart us. Here's our fifth variation. And we have a 1-2-3-4 note descent. 1-2-3-4. 1-2-3-4. So he's providing a balance, this arch, as he goes through. And then we come back to a reiteration of our extensio. Bach. And here in the soprano, our ordering is different. But Bach is he's elaborating on it. He's not just extending the dissonance, but then he has what they would have called a subsumptio. We would just call it a lower neighbor tone. But it's that weeping figure extended. Bach, piatom. I know it's not a big deal. None of this is amazing. You say, oh, that's not a big deal. But then when you listen to it all in the end, it communicates so much more than anything that's been written in the last 100 years when they're writing about the crucifixion, right? You know, I hate to do this. I don't mean to offend, but, you know, you came from heaven to earth to show the way from the earth to the cross. My debts to pay just doesn't establish credibility. It doesn't, the music in no way communicates crucifixion. It just creates kind of bob along and have a good time. It's good to, you know, drink your coffee and drive down the street to. But it says nothing to you about the crucifixion of Christ. And this music does is Bach manipulates the musical elements of sound and time. So, that's the fourth and fifth variations. And then this continues a while. I apologize for all this back and forth. I knew it would be like this. I'm going to scan ahead towards the end here of the this main section of the divisio. And here there's a huge change. And we'll listen to it again later and you'll hear it. But everything has been one voice, next voice, next voice. And we get a figure called the noema, or a repeated noema is called the mimesis, as the musicians use those terms. And what that was for a musician was, in the context of a polyphonic piece, there's an insertion of a homophonic section, meaning all the voices are moving together, like our hymns. Everybody's singing at the same pace, usually. But here we get at the word pastus for the first time, the suffering, everybody's lining up. But in addition to just lining everybody up, Bach employs what's called a dubitatio. Something's doubting, it doesn't quite make sense. The way that this lines up is there's another motive idea. Ba, be, bum, bum, be, bum. Next page is up again. The bass is saying, ba, be, bum, ba, bum, bum. And they do it actually one more time. They do it three times. And the text doesn't line up with the meter anymore. And the different voices don't quite line up the same. And the harmonies disagree with the bass line all of a sudden. Here's the bass main note. And I'm on the second beat where the pastus enters, and both the bass and soprano have that note. And you say, oh, what's Bach doing? Come on, that doesn't sound like Bach. Well, in context it does, right? Bach is leaping or just piling on a dissonance now that's really unprepared. He's building his case of the awfulness of the crucifixion. Next slide. And back. Starting to get the hang of this. Okay. Wrapping this up, we conclude here. Again, we see the introduction of this extensio. So there's kind of a rounding out of the main argument here. And we get the first time in the piece, a cadence. A cadence, a kind of resting point, or some sense of conclusion. And it's taken us to measure 35 to get a cadence. He's never let it rest. But it's not a finished cadence. This is what's called a half cadence. We're not there yet. But let me confirm the matter with you. The confirmatio. And we see, like the beginning, the extensio, but again, it's altered this time. We've come from this consonant note, the B, and then we rearticulate this extensio, this dissonance, but this time, he doesn't go right down to the resolution, he skips down. If I drew a line between B and B and C and A sharp, again, I get the cross. And Bach's employing here the chi, the chiasmus, in the idea that he started the piece with. So we're getting a confirmation of the argument. Again, Bach's trying to convince you, persuade you of the text. The piece starts to open up, it reaches its climax, and the voices become more melodic. And the basses reach way down. And everything starts to open up. So the arms are opening up. I don't know if Bach was thinking of the arms opening up on the cross or not, but the whole music opens up here. There's a great climax before the conclusion of our arguments, which... Where'd it go? Here we are. After opening up to its greatest heights, you see the sopranos come down. And even the bass finally reaches the lowest notes that likely they could sing. It's all settled down, and we finally cadence on the resting tone, the place of final rest. But Bach says, let me conclude the peroratio, which is here. You remember the exordium had all the instruments, but no singers? Now we have no instruments and just the singers. We see here, there's been this constant hanging on to the tension, and finally releases. Here, coming into the peroratio, the soprano changes. It doesn't hang over, it anticipates the rest. It's called an anticipatio. We would just call it anticipation today. And then the soprano does it again. The F comes too early. See the E's, if you read music? Everyone's singing E, and the soprano anticipates the move. They're anticipating something to come. You know what it is. We get one more version of that hanging over, the extensio. The basses are finally doubling for the very first time, doubling that continual line, seeing the same notes. But two things. Right here, the use of a flat for the first time in the piece. The use of a flat would have been used to soften or to lower, of course, to lower something, but also to soften a dissonance. It's also changing our point of reference, our orientation. Just in the same time, then under the bass, bom, bom, be, ba, oops, bom, is turning back up. Bum, bum, bum. And we end on a G major chord. Now what on earth? This is very unusual. Laments don't end on a relative major. They don't end with a happy chord at the end. Well, Bach's trying to communicate something to you. In all of this great anguish, there's an anticipation. Bach knew he was going to suffer, but he knew the joy set before him. And his final resting place wasn't in Hades. Right? He descends, but he's coming back. Here's the very last five bars, as best as I can do them. Bach says, no, it's not going to end there. He's communicating in the music what's going on in the text. So I'm going to play it for you one more time. You've got a little bit more. I'll try to keep the score going as you listen. Petrucci Pieces. Not just the text, not just the music to hang the words on. Bach's trying to communicate to you, crucifixus etiam promobis, to you in the music, apart from the words. Right? Not, that's not important. That's the whole reason for the music. So listen. Up. Oops, down a little bit. And all we can just talk about that. You're saying, oh, the time's up. What if parents in schools, churches, were to train up their children to be musically literate? What if the average Christian sitting in the pew possessed a musical literacy greater than that of a typical college music major graduate? And I submit to you, that's not a hard task. What if the church were to have such a musical transformation? Can you imagine if the average congregants or students could readily sing and understand the motets of Palestrina, or the anthems of Tallis and Byrd, or the cantatas of Bach, or the oratorios of Handel? Can you imagine if the average congregant or the average student could write their own compositions, not just a tune, a composition? Luther wrote compositions. He was not a music major. If this were the case, what might the compositions and performances of highly skilled professional musicians be like? I'm not sure I can imagine it. But if it were to come to pass, it would certainly be more glorious, more perfected, more like the heavenly worship pictured in the book of Revelation. If we want the next generation of Christians to play skillfully and sing beautifully, to sing with understanding, to take dominion of sound and time, to change the musical culture of the church and the world, we must teach them and we must train them. We cannot give them a smattering of grammar, a dash of dialectic, and then a choice of an ill-prepared rhetoric. Worse yet would be to teach a strong grammatical and dialectical foundation and then not leave them to the fruit of their labors. No, we must make music education core and central, part of our paideia education. And if we all agree that a student will be like his teacher, then we must seek to hire or train teachers to be like Chenaniah, Bach, and Kodaly. The Association of Classical Christian Schools is extremely well positioned to implement musical instruction in such a way which would have, I believe, a monumental, long-term effect on worship and culture, not only in our constituent schools and churches, but throughout the nation. John Newton closed his famous hymn, Amazing Grace, with these words: "When we've been there 10,000 years, bright, shining as the sun, we've no less days to do small group studies and exegetical studies. No, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. Why aren't we starting? But we know we're called to sing praises to God while here on earth. We know that we'll be singing praises forever before the throne of God. I challenge us to rethink the extent to which we use, value, and enjoy the great gift of music. I exhort us to more seriously study how God has ordered sound and time and what he reveals about himself therein, and how faithful, skillful musical servants who have gone before us have endeavored to do this. I encourage us to consider making a greater investment in training up all our students to be musically literate. May God bring it to pass according to his will and for his glory. Soli Deo Gloria. Thank you."